I'm Janet Forrest, and this is the Nantucket Athenaeum Podcast. In this season of the podcast, my colleague James Greeter and I are going to take you on a journey through time. You'll find out about the faces and frivolities that graced, or maybe disgraced, the stage of the Great Hall. You'll meet musicians, lecturers, and illusionists, some of repute and some, well, not. Who were these folks that made the long 30-mile trek to Nantucket, and how were they received by the islanders? Welcome to Tonight in Athenaeum Hall. This is Episode 2, The Nantucket Lyceum. On Saturday, April 17, 1852, the following notice appeared in the Nantucket Weekly Mirror.
Nantucket Lyceum. Regular meeting of the Nantucket Lyceum at Athenaeum Hall on Monday evening next at 6:30. Lecture by Reverend Ethan Allen. Question: Is it consistent with the Christian character to participate in games or dancing or to witness exhibitions of the drama? The lecture will commence at precisely 7:00, at which time the doors will be closed and remain closed until the end of the lecture.
Okay, James, tell me about the Lyceum movement in the U.S.
The Lyceum movement in the States was a collection of adult education programs, basically, that flourished particularly in the Northeast and the Midwest. And it was named after the place where Aristotle lectured to the youth in ancient Greece. And it was location associated with philosophical teaching and discourse, so a natural name for such a movement or such an activity. And the Athenaeum was a natural location for that to happen here on Nantucket, to be set. The first Lyceum was founded in 1826 here in Massachusetts by Josiah Holbrook, who was a teacher and a lecturer. He was also a traveling lecturer himself. He believed that education was a lifelong experience and so wanted to provide opportunities for adult Americans to continue their learning beyond 13, maybe, which was the age a lot of them had finished their schooling. If you were lucky enough to go on to high school, obviously you would have more than to college, but a lot of folks didn't have that additional education. And Americans were hungry for knowledge of the outside world. They wanted to know about science. They wanted to know about geography. There were demonstrations of physics and things like that on the stage, optics. They were just fascinated by all of this information and wanted to know as much as they could about the world around them and their place in it, basically. Essentially, at first, though, it was a local thing. So the Lyceum might be set up in a town, and then they would ask the speakers from their town if they would participate. And the speakers traditionally were the preachers in the various pulpits. And so they would each give their lecture. And then, as you might have experienced working with events, you've run out of all the people. You go back to the same well again. People get a little bit tired of hearing the same speech every time. And so you start looking further afield, where am I going to get more folks? And this is where the Lyceum movement was very helpful because it provided a traveling circuit of speakers who would visit various small towns and would provide their services for a small fee. In fact, one of the most famous speakers, his name was Thomas Starr King. He was a Unitarian minister, and you might have seen his name associated with various divinity schools. He said that there were only 5 people in America who now had a mix a Lyceum lecture, and I think I'm one of the 5. So it's Thomas Starr King came up with a little catchphrase for himself when he was asked what his payment was or honorarium was for each lecture that he did. And he said, it's fame, F-A-M-E, 50 in my expenses. They didn't get paid a lot, but at the time it was a decent salary for a traveling lecturer who might be in one town for a couple of nights and then someplace else the next. They would tour all over their entire region, sometimes even further afield. You have people like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Frederick Douglass, Henry David Thoreau, Daniel Webster, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Susan B. Anthony. Even Abraham Lincoln gave a speech to a Lyceum in Springfield, Illinois. And many of Emerson's essays were originally written as Lyceum lectures. And indeed, he makes a note in his autobiography about how people in smaller towns were the test market for his speeches. So he would be working on them on the road. And he said, I saved my best stuff basically for the big cities. And it's interesting to see the reviews of Emerson's lectures in the Inquirer Mirror here. They're like, Mr. Emerson's lecture was a little confusing, or Mr. Emerson should have worked on his lecture a little bit more. And so they clearly had an, you know, they understood that they were maybe not getting the final polished product.
Well, it almost reminds me of comedians that do like Netflix specials.
Yes.
On the road for about a year working on 10 minutes at a time, bit by bit by bit. And then finally they have, you know, a solid hour of material, and that's when they go on Netflix.
Absolutely. I think that's an excellent, excellent analogy of how they went about their business, especially Emerson, who would then publish those essays, Thoreau too, in their collected work. So a lot of those were developed during that time. But I think that the comedian is an excellent example where he's in a dive bar, sorry, Athenaeum, or, you know, some podunk town, sorry, Nantucket, where, you know, you're just trying out this material, and then you take it to the big stage in Boston or New York City or something of that sort. The focus of the Lyceum in general, as I said, was education. And that kind of had a natural correlation with the establishment of public schools and broadening school curricula, having parents more interested in what their children were learning and wanting them to have a better education, along with the development of local museums and libraries like the Athenaeum in the United States. And the Lyceum movement kind of waxed and waned over the years. It started here on Nantucket shortly after it was first introduced up in Millbrook, but it didn't seem to have been much of an organized event or activity for a while after that. They would refer to something as the Lyceum Hall. This is prior to the Great Fire that was downtown, that is apparently was distinct from the Athenaeum, but it doesn't seem to have gotten much use. So it might have been a dual purpose building where they just simply called it that when they weren't using it for a barn or whatever it was at the time. That eventually did go away, though, and that resulted in the merging, the joining of the Lyceum with the Athenaeum after the fire. And then the movement continued to wax and wane. It reached its peak of popularity just before the Civil War. And then after the war, kind of blended into the Chautauqua movement, which is still around today. The one that I think of in particular is, I think, upstate New York, where they've got a facility that started kind of in the 1870s. During this time, also, the focus started to change from sort of lectures and more intellectual activities to things like traveling entertainers, ventriloquists, vaudeville entertainers, and minstrel shows. But they were still used for public speeches, too. Folks like Mark Twain, William Lloyd Garrison, they all spoke at Lyceums in the late 19th century. So some of the speakers at the Athenaeum, I mentioned before, it was Emerson. Thoreau came here and spoke. While he was here, he stayed at what was then the Ocean House, now the Jared Coffin House. He did a hand-sketched map of Nantucket that you can find online that's kind of a neat artifact to check out. We also had a lot of local, as I mentioned at the top, a lot of local speakers who were either doctors or lawyers or clergymen who were here on Nantucket. So Dr. Charles Winslow, who you might have heard the story of his heart being buried.
Oh, yeah.
Yep, separately. So he was a speaker. He was a doctor here on the island. You had Reverend Judkins, who was the minister at the Methodist Church, who spoke. Dr. Hannaford, who was a big advocate of water therapy, which was kind of in vogue at the time for treating disease. And the formats of the Lyceum meetings had an interesting setup. They would have the speaker first give the lecture, and then completely, sometimes unrelated to that, you would have a debate. And so the question would be posed. For example, the lecture back in 1852 by Ethan Allen, who was a minister, the lecture was on the family, the state, and the church. The Lyceum debate was, is it consistent with a Christian character to participate in games or dancing or to witness exhibitions of the dramas? And then they would have assigned debaters. So it was kind of like high school debate class. And you would have assigned debaters. They might agree or disagree themselves personally, but regardless, they were debating that particular position, and people would sit there in the audience and listen to them present their cases. So it was it had a very kind of collegiate feel, I think, to it, because people really were, and the topics, as I said, it could be anything from science, pneumatics, chemistry. They would use chemistry to perform magic tricks, basically to kind of combine that showmanship aspect with the science. Think of the Mr. Wizard or who's like Bill Nye or something of that sort these days, who does kind of the same thing.
How did the speakers compare back then to the speakers in more recent history that have come to the Athenaeum?
Primarily in that many of the speakers that came were trained classically in speaking, in public speaking and elocution. In fact, there was an entire lecture on elocution and it involved not only how you spoke in terms of the words, but also how you looked when you were speaking and positions and stances and things of that sort. So I think it was sometimes a much more theatrical event that you'd be experiencing. And if you read some of the lectures, it does feel very dramatic. Some of them feel very dramatic. You can really sense the power of the words there. Others are more of a dry scientific basis, but they all have that 19th century, for the most part, 19th century feel of being kind of a little bit overwrought by our modern standards.
So you talked about fame, 50 in my expenses. Yeah. So who paid those fees? And then the people that wanted to attend, who was allowed to attend and what did they have to pay?
That evolved over time. Initially, well, let's start with the payment. The payment would sometimes be done by subscription. And so it would say, like, Mr. Emerson is considering a course of 3 lectures on Nantucket. If there's sufficient interest, if you'd like to subscribe to that, you can come by so-and-so's shop and, you know, pay a fee, basically. And once there was enough of an amount accumulated, then the person would come down. When it became more formalized, they had an established situation where they would be paid sort of a set rate through that process. But before that, I think it was much more ad hoc. And sometimes people ended up not coming because there wasn't enough interest and people didn't raise the money. Most of the time, the fee was usually 25 cents for general admission, and that would be anybody that wanted to go. The problem that they started to run into, though, was the popularity of the Lyceum speeches and lectures, and there wasn't sufficient seating for everybody. So they moved to an arrangement where they had tickets available for the proprietors, and they could guarantee seating for the proprietors.
Let's back up and talk a little bit about how it merged with the Athenaeum and how there was a little bit of a conflict there in terms of who got in and who was part of it and who wasn't.
So the Lyceum and the Athenaeum had, I guess, overlapping missions, you could say. So certainly it seemed like a natural alliance and a way to share resources and to make use of a great space, but it also led to some confusion because the Lyceum was a general broad-based movement. The Athenaeum did allow public access, but it also had the proprietors who were guaranteed to have tickets. What would happen is they would run out of, as I mentioned before, they would run out of tickets, run out of space. People would get upset. I'm a proprietor. I should be able to come in. It's already full. And when I say full, I'm talking not fire code full. We're talking 300 people upstairs. I mean, that is packed in there.
Well, and what people forget is you go into the Great Hall now and there's the tables and the stacks and there's the teen center. But back in the day, that day, there was nothing there, right? It was just a hall, right? Hall with seats. That was it.
Exactly. Yes. It was kind of stadium seating at first, and then they eventually put in sort of regular individual chairs, but it was kind of just like benches, but there would be people standing all over the place as well. And if you can imagine, there are a couple of times where there are letters to the editor saying, I would have stayed longer, but it was so hot. It's just stifling in that
before
room.
Before fire code and climate control.
And climate control and everybody wearing like wool and just packed. Oh, it must have been brutal. Absolutely brutal. But they were so hungry for knowledge. They were willing to put up with all of this. But yeah, so the crowding became an issue, access. And the proprietor said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to increase the number of proprietors so that we increase the annual dues amounts. And we're also going to limit the access to the proprietors themselves. One of the complaints that they had was that, you know, we're providing this space. We're only charging 25 cents for admission, which is basically just covering the cost of, you know, the people coming and whatnot, and maybe cleaning up afterwards and having somebody at the door. But we also, like, we have a large debt that we're servicing. We always want to get more books. So like, where is the benefit to the institution of the Athenaeum as such? Why should they be doing this and not? Why are we not charging more money for it, basically? But it was also in part because at this point, the audience was becoming more and more the proprietors of the Athenaeum, which created another problem because then you had to delineate, okay, well, this person is a member of the Lyceum, but they're not a proprietor. So you had this when it came to like picking who was going to be the speaker, all these decisions about that the dual nature of the membership started to cause a problem. They kind of had to separate the two out eventually. The Lyceum sort of went, maybe not defunct, but it was in hibernation for some time until it came back in the 1870s after the war.
Well, we keep it right, nice and simple now. It's free to get in. It's first come, first serve.
Yeah. It eliminates a lot of that complaining, I think, when you don't promise anybody anything.
If you could go back and hear one of the lecturers, which event would you like to be at?
Oh, Frederick Douglass, for sure. I mean, from what has been said about him as a speaker with his native talents, and then, you know, knowing now what we know about who he was, you know, the first time that he spoke here, which is the famous speech that he gave at the Athenaeum, he isn't even listed amongst the people who were at the convention because he was just, you know, whoever he was, we don't know who he is. He's just from New Bedford, some guy who was a slave. And yeah, just, I think to see, to hear him speak, I think would be remarkable. I'm not sure I'd want to be there for Emerson. I like his writings. I think I would probably wait for the final draft. It sounds like that was a bit confusing. Thoreau had his standard, you know, sort of speeches that he gave everywhere that he went. Again, same sort of thing that he'd been polishing over time. So that would be interesting only to experience it firsthand from him. But I think Douglass would be my first choice.
This has been a production of the Nantucket Athenaeum. It was hosted and edited by me, Janet Forrest. Special thanks to Reference Library Associate James Greeter for his knowledge and research. The opening announcement was voiced by Andrew Cromarty. Please check the show notes for more information and references. You can find all the previous episodes of this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening now. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe to make sure you never miss an episode. If you have an idea for what we should talk about next, send us an email at jforrest@nantucketathenaeum.org. The Nantucket Athenaeum is located at 1 India Street in Nantucket, Massachusetts. We would love for you to stop by. You can find us online at nantucketathenaeum.org or search at Nantucket Athenaeum on Facebook and Instagram. Thanks for listening. And if you love this episode, share it with a friend.